All right, good evening. Thank you so much to Raleigh for that introduction and to all of the amazing people with Gulf Restoration Network. I am extremely excited to be here, and so the first thing that I'm going to do is take your all's picture so I can share it with everybody else, so hang on. As Raleigh said in my introduction, I have been writing about oil, thinking about oil, studying oil, looking at the impacts of oil for what feels like a very, very, very long time, including from the very start of BP's disaster in the Gulf. And I've looked at all of, definitely a wide variety of oil catastrophes in a very wide variety of ways, from the deserts of Afghanistan to the depths of the Amazon forest, to the tip of the Arctic, and to the bottom of the ocean. And I was in a submarine a year and a half ago at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico at the site of the BP oil spill. And we got closer than anyone had been since the disaster happened to the Macondo well. We couldn't get any closer than we got because the wreckage of the Deepwater Horizon is still down there, basically as a sarcophagus to the 11 men who died in the rig. Obviously their bodies weren't recovered. And I wrote a feature article for Harper's Magazine based on that experience that came out in the June issue. But there is a paragraph that got cut from it that I'm going to read for you all. I spent 2 weeks on the Atlantis Research Vessel, which is the vessel that accompanies the Alvin submarine, with a team of amazing scientists, led by Dr. Samantha Joy from Athens, Georgia. And I stayed on the Atlantis, and then we did the dive in the Alvin submarine. So I wrote this. I had a nightmare my last night on the Atlantis. It consisted of one image. Here lie the remains of the 2010 BP oil disaster. The simple wooden marker, a thick cross with it, with a sign nailed on front, like those dotting the desert settings of Roadrunner cartoons, is old and worn. It has been sitting on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico for over 1,000 years. It is a sign for tourists, in this case, aliens visiting the most infamous sites of a curious planet long since made uninhabitable by a species known as humans, in quotation marks. Just like the vastness of the Grand Canyon, the sign stands at the edge of a great expanse, miles of weathered BP oil stretching out as far as the eye can see, a blanket forever coating the ocean floor. So I wrote that, and the 1,000 years actually wasn't an exaggeration. It was a quote that a scientist on board said to me when I came up from the Alvin. And he said, when an expedition comes here in 1,000 years, they're going to know exactly what happened here, because they're going to see the vast blanket of oil that's now at the bottom of the ocean. And what I saw down there is, well, what I saw down there is nothing. So what could get away from the oil got away. What could swim, swam. What couldn't was Newt. And what's down there is a moonscape. There is a vast blanket of oil. It's 3,000 square miles long. It's the size of Delaware and Rhode Island. And it's going to be there forever. The bottom of the ocean is very cold. And what's also left are the most toxic parts of the oil, the parts that the microbes that eat oil didn't want. Too nasty for them to eat. So they left it behind. And it is, so of the oil that was spilled, 30 million gallons remain in the Gulf. That's the equivalent of 3 Exxon Valdez-sized oil spills still in the Gulf ecosystem. About half of that is on the bottom of the ocean. It has impacts that will also last forever. So all the species that used to live in that, in those states of Rhode Island and Delaware, don't live there now. They're slowly starting to come back. So Dr. Joy also led the previous Alvin mission to the bottom of the ocean, which happened in December 2010, right after the spill. And then we were there a year and a half ago, so 4 years later. And whereas she had seen absolutely nothing, we saw the occasional little fish flitting by, probably looking for other fish and not finding them. The occasional eel, the occasional crab, all very isolated. We saw a vampire squid, which was incredible and beautiful, one of the oldest creatures on the planet, go zooming by our window. But otherwise, I intentionally waited to find out what I would have expected to see until after so that I wouldn't have expectations. But I expected to see something. And what we should have seen is just more life, more stuff, more variety of species, sharks, sea fans, and more of everything that we did see. And what's down there is basically struggling to survive in this new environment. And while there's good news in the fact that we saw some species, there's also bad news in that. Because what that means is that the species that come into that oil field are consuming what they're finding. And when they consume what they find, the next species that consumes them takes up those toxins. And so it travels up the food chain. And that's probably not concerning in terms of, for example, the safety of what we might consume. We're not talking those types of quantities. But we're talking the survival of those species, which means we're also talking about our ability to survive on this planet, which is one of the reasons why I had that dream. Because one of the species that's being most impacted is phytoplankton. It's absorbing the stuff from the bottom. And the phytoplankton needs to live for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons why we like to think it needs to live is because we need it to live. So phytoplankton provides 50% of the CO2 on the planet. Without healthy phytoplankton, we don't have an atmosphere that we can breathe. And it is one of the many species that is impacted by this oil. So when we think about this oil spill, spill is obviously an inappropriate word, but honestly, as a writer, I've never been able to come up with the right word. Nothing feels appropriate. Because actually, in many ways, we got lucky. What happened with BP was a pipe that fell and sprung a leak. This is the result of a crack in a pipe. Imagine if it had disgorged. So this is a spill. And this spill, the world's largest offshore oil spill, has a dollar value on it. So Raleigh said it, this is a lot of money. It magically went from $8.7 billion, which was what the settlement value was when it was first reported, to $20 billion today. that magic number, there's no additional money in there. They just finally realized that they could show the number looking more because they're gonna get interest off of the money, and the money's doled out over 15 years. And so that interest was added to the calculation. And now that put it up to 20 billion. And that is a big number. But my background is in public policy. So one of the things that I look at is, what does the law say? BP broke the law. It caused the largest offshore oil drilling spill in history. It's caused so much damage that we can barely put our heads around it. When you look at the documents that just on Monday, as Raleigh said, the Department of Justice and NOAA released all the settlement documents. So the terms of the settlement are now available. And they released them because it's open to a public comment period for 60 days. And there are actually public meetings being held where people can come and talk about what they think about the disaster, about the way the government's handled it, about the way BP has handled it. And there's one of those meetings is coming up in New Orleans. There's one coming up in Houma this month. Actually, I wrote them down. New Orleans is October 22nd. Houma is the 19th. And the letter of the law, which is one of the things I believe in, is that BP was supposed to pay $14 billion just for breaking the law. You spill oil, you pay a fine. That fine was $18 billion. So everything else was on top of that. All the economic damage, the damage to states, the damage to the environment. So to me, BP got off easy.
We don't have
off yet,
don't we?
Hmm? Oh, that's not me. Someone got a question? That isn't to say, however, that this settlement shouldn't be celebrated, because this is what we got, and we need the money, and it's a lot of money, and this is a hard battle to fight, and it is a huge success to get this much money out of this company. And we need to cheer the hard work of Gulf Restoration Network for helping bring this settlement about, and also helping to push the Restore Act, which means that money actually comes here to do restoration, which it wouldn't have otherwise. And we have to cheer that success. But we also have to continue to put that money in context so that we hold our regulators' feet to the fire and we hold the oil companies' feet to the fire to make sure that they know, yeah, $20 billion, it's a lot of money. You got off cheap. And we are going to hold you and every other company and every other regulator. We're going to be there every time. We're going to watch every time. And for the next guy, BP got off cheap. $20 billion was easy. We got it. We worked for it. We organized for it. The money's coming here, and we're ready to do it again. So that money actually does what it's supposed to do, in addition to provide, actually restore what's been broken, because the letter of the law also says that BP is legally required to put everything back the way it was. That's the law. They broke it, they have to fix it. Everything. That's the law. We have that law, by the way, as a result of the Exxon Valdez spill, as a result of Bush Senior. Big Bush. Don't you know? What are you pointing to? That is a result of Exxon Valdez spill and the need to say, okay, if something like this happens, it has to be restored. And that's very, very, very hard work, and it's a huge accomplishment that after Valdez, the Oil Pollution Act was passed, this law is available, this law has been used as a result of the BP oil spill, the Restore Act was passed, this law is being used. And all of that is the result of activism and organizing and lawsuits and protests and day-to-day hard work organizing, like that which Gulf Restoration Network does. But we also can't have another one of these disasters happen again. And a very disturbing finding that came out just about 2 weeks ago is a study that was done by David Hammer, an amazing local journalist who used to be with the Times-Picayune, and is now at a local television station. And he did an investigation of the regulatory agency, BSEE, that's supposed to be overseeing the environmental capacity of offshore oil drillers. And he found that they're just simply not up to the task. And that's very worrisome. But this also comes within the context of, remember, and I said this was going to be helpful. So this hard work that happened in response to the BP oil spill, all of the amazing organizing, awareness, protests, lawsuits, everything, did have an enormous effect on the public psyche around, one, the threats about what an oil spill can mean, because believe me, there was a very strong attempt, and I'm sure you all are well aware, to very immediately paint this as everything was fine, right? There is no problem, there is no oil out there, the beaches are clean. But there was also a very concerted effort to expose the truth and to make sure that the truth continued to come out. And the American public did hear that. And the American public is very concerned about offshore oil drilling. And when Shell arrived in Alaska, it tried very hard to make deals with local Alaskan communities. It did make deals with local Alaskan communities. But as I said, I was just up at the tip of the Arctic. I was in Wainwright, Alaska, which is the closest community to where Shell's drilling was taking place, at the tip of the Arctic. And Wainwright is a teeny little 550-person Inupiat village, incredibly dependent on the land and the sea. They are subsistence whalers. They depend on whale and seal and caribou. And each one of them, when I would talk to them, would say, hey, they were 70 miles from where Shell was drilling. And they would say, if there's a spill, like in Louisiana, that's it for us. And they were very well aware of what had happened here. And they were deeply concerned about what the impacts would be. And of course, people began organizing in a very concerted way, in a very powerful way, around Shell's Arctic drilling. And as someone who's followed the oil industry for a very long time, short of the Keystone XL pipeline, I don't think there's been any equivalent coordinated protest effort of the same caliber as around the Shell Arctic drilling. And that included millions of people signing petitions. It included very targeted direct action that was meant to slow Shell's operations down. And that was done because Shell, because of the opposition and the concern around the safety around offshore drilling, because of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, because of public concern, because of public pressure, because of lawsuits, because of concerns in the Obama administration, basically Shell's capacity to drill in the Arctic was whittled down and down and down and down, such that they were limited to a 3-month drilling period, that's it, and they could only effectively drill one hole at a time. So anyone who knows anything about oil knows that that's not a lot. And so the protesters in Seattle and in Portland, if you saw them hanging off of the bridge in Portland, creating a human barricade so that the rigs couldn't come and go. They were dangling off of anchors when the rigs were docked in Washington State. The kayaktivists were blocking the rig. All of that was around publicity, but it was also a very specific tactic, which was the shorter of a window that Shell had to drill, and it couldn't drill unless it had its full armada in the Arctic, the less opportunity they had to succeed. And what they ended up doing was they got one hole drilled. It didn't show enough oil to justify their continued operations. And so on the day that they were supposed to wrap up, they said, you know what, we're wrapping up and we're packing up. And one of the reasons why Shell made that decision was a result of that public pressure. And there's two reasons why. And I'm going to explain these very quickly. But I have an article coming out in Newsweek on Tuesday where I go through all of this. So please look for that. But it's basically two pieces. One is Shell is trying to engage in the largest oil merger in world, the second largest oil merger in history, short of Exxon and Mobil merging. It's trying to buy a company called BG Group, based in London. Well, one of the places where Shell faced a lot of protests was in London. a two-decker bus-sized polar bear was camped out in front of their London headquarters for a week. A 10-piece string orchestra played Ode to the Arctic in front of their headquarters for a week. There were actions for an entire month. And when those ended, Prince Charles booted Shell out of a group that Shell had helped found to address climate change in advance of the United Nations climate talks in Paris. And Prince Charles very publicly booted them out over their Arctic drilling. And to have a merger, you need regulators who feel that the public is going to accept them okaying your merger. And that was looking less and less likely. In addition, Shell needs another permit to drill. If it finds oil out there, it has to get another permit to get it. The capacity to get that permit was looking slimmer and slimmer as well. Do y'all remember President Obama went to Alaska last month, and he made a very public plea for action on climate before the United Nations Paris talk that's coming up in November? Well, I think for a lot of us, while he was doing that, which was very important, Shell's oil rig was looming, you know, like a backdrop to every selfie and GoPro video he took of himself. And that hypocrisy stayed with him on that trip. And I think it's quite possible that he felt he didn't want that as his legacy. He thought it would harm his negotiating position going into Paris. And he might have let it be known that that permit might not come so easy. But whether or not he did that, the two leading potential Democratic candidates for president made it very clear that they weren't going to grant that permit. Now, I don't think Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, maybe Bernie Sanders, I don't think Hillary Clinton just woke up one day and was like, yeah, I don't think Shell should drill. I think Hillary Clinton was influenced by an environmental constituency that was very anti-Shell drilling, and she wanted to court that constituency. And the way she courted it was to say, I'm not going to grant those permits. And so Shell knew it wasn't going to get the permits. So it also made a decision to pull out. Now, these are just two of the factors, but it's a huge shift for a company of this size to take a $7 billion loss and pull out of the Arctic. And what this says to me is, in addition to the success here of reaching the settlement, in addition to the success of stopping what could have been, in many ways, an even more disastrous set of operations, organizing, holding the company's feet to the fire, holding our elected officials' feet to the fire, actually using direct action works. And that we have to keep doing more of that and supporting the organizations that are doing more of that and supporting Gulf Restoration Network. I've written a lot of detailed articles about BP's decision. If you're interested in Rolling Stone, there's a bunch of articles there that are fairly detailed. My Harper's article, if you want to see more. And my book, Black Tide, which you can, what's it called, bid on. I can sign it, and then you can give money to Gulf Restoration Network that way. But a lot of resources. And I'm here. And I'm here because I want to support the work that you're all doing. So thank you very much for having me, and thank you for the work that you do.